own from a position of weakness. And I think that what we have to construct in view of all of these new coercive actions and violence, international violence through military intervention and sanctions that the United States has recovered as a exercise of control, the only alternative that we have is what we call the geopolitics of the weak, getting together, coordinating our diplomatic actions, and using international law in a strategic way. I think that we have to recover the moral narrative of international law with a connection with Europe, with the United States, with all the progressive sectors of society everywhere. Because what is happening in Latin America is not just Latin America's problem, as what is happening in Gaza is not just the Middle Eastern problem. They are all connected, and it has to do with the United States losing hegemony internationally with the rise of China, of India, of Russia. And I think that the only way forward has to be to resist, but also to act and create resilience through a common interest that we can discover, like energy and like migration.
Senator Clara Lopez Obregón, we have to leave it there, but we're going to do this interview in Spanish and post online at democracynow.org/ES. Yes, Colombian Senator Clara Lopez Obregón speaking to us from Bogota. That does it for our show. Very happy birthday to Hugh Grant. I'll be in Santa Barbara this weekend at the International Film Festival. Hope to see people there Friday and Saturday.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
Independent media is now more important than ever, and we want to know how KBOO Community Radio can best serve you. KBOO's Board of Directors invites you to a community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater and online via public video conference. This is your opportunity to share feedback, offer ideas, and help guide the station's direction. The meeting will be followed by a social hour. That's KBOO Community Radio's community meeting on Saturday, February 21st at 11:30 a.m. at the Clinton Street Theater. For more information, visit kboo.fm/community26.
Well, today we'll hear a story about young people who, during World War II, did some major sneaking around under the noses of the Nazis. Stay with me. I'm Bert Cohen, and with your help, we are keeping democracy alive.
He's not breathing.
Can you get a pulse?
Barely.
We see the big bombs, the artillery, the massive destruction of war, the movement of troops, but just as important, if not more so, is the hidden espionage, smuggling secrets and goods from under the nose of the more powerful enemy. That's what saves lives and wins wars. I saw examples of amazing ingenuity myself at the Museum of the Resistance in Oslo, Norway, a number of years ago. The brilliant ways and notes and valuables were smuggled, hidden as they passed under the watchful eyes of the Nazis' quisling government in fascist-occupied Norway, World War II. The heroes who hid the intelligent and other valuable information may never be known. This show, Keeping Democracy Alive, is, as you know, generally aimed at adults, people who are able to participate in political and cultural change. But a great many adults also have children, and even if they don't, do care greatly about the world we're leaving for the next generations. And they share a desire for young people to be clever and successful in protecting their and our freedom. Our focus today is a book aimed at young adults called Secret Buttons, a suspenseful coming-of-age novel capturing a tween girl's perspective and incredibly valuable creativity in the years leading to World War II and the Holocaust. But it's hardly just a history book for young adults. Today, there's a lot of consciousness that the Trump war on much of the world in general, and on Americans in specific, leads unsurprisingly but disturbingly to comparisons to that period leading up to the Nazi era. And don't we know it? As we're seeing every day, there's a need for individual bravery and group cohesiveness in fighting what has become 21st century Gestapo, which has been unleashed at ever-increasing levels on the otherwise peaceful streets of America, most notably Minneapolis. The book we'll talk about today is Secret Buttons, and it's based on the true story of the author's mother, who grew up in Vienna, Austria, and had her education interrupted in 1938 by the Anschluss, the Nazi takeover of Austria. And ultimately, she opened and ran a needlework shop in multicultural Inglewood, California. The story aims at catching the attention of young adult readers is that it seems that the author's mother had been involved in a secret operation to help Jewish refugees secure a future in America by crocheting buttons with diamonds inside. Aha, sneaky. The story does remind me of a film I saw about 20 years ago called The Time in Between, about a Spanish seamstress hiding secret messages and jewels inside clothing during the Spanish Civil War when fascists were victorious against freedom-loving Spaniards. Our guest on today's unique edition of Keeping Democracy Alive is Ellen M. Shapiro, author of the book The Secret Buttons. Let's see what we and young readers can learn from this book. Ellen Shapiro is a graphic designer and writer, a graduate of UCLA's College of Fine Arts. She's headed a graphic communications firm for over 20 years and taught at leading design schools, including the Designer as Author MFA program at New York's School of Visual Arts. A contributing editor for Print Magazine and a writer for printmag.com, she's published hundreds of articles and posts and two nonfiction books about visual culture around the world. Inspired by her mother's memories of the Holocaust in Vienna, in life in wartime England, The Secret Buttons is her first novel. Ellen Shapiro, thanks so much for being with us on Keeping Democracy Alive.
Well, thank you so much for that incredible, long, detailed, an accurate introduction.
I'm really
happy to be here.
Well, Ellen Shapiro explores thoroughly researched, well-documented World War II history and experiences and her mother's mysterious recollection through the eyes of a resourceful tween heroine, Annie Blum. But before we hear about Annie Blum, which we will, what was the inspiration for writing The Secret Buttons? Who's the audience? Why did you write it?
See, there are two reasons that I wrote it. One was that this singular and mysterious, as you put it, recollection of my mother, you know, kept percolating in my mind even 20 years after she died at age 92. And she told me to keep it a secret.
Uh-huh.
But after she died, I just told a few people, and they said, really? Wow, did your mom really do that? Or people who lived in Inglewood said, you know, I knew Liesl, she really did that, didn't she? She was always knitting, she was always crocheting. She taught us how to knit and how to make all these beautiful things. So it was really one sentence she told me when I was 10 years old. She said, when I lived in England, and I wish I could imitate her German-British accent, but I won't even try. When I lived in England during the blackout and the Blitz, I crocheted around diamonds and I made them into buttons that I sewed onto sweaters that refugees wore on the boats to America.
Mm. That takes some real ingenuity and chutzpah, dare I say. Okay, so please tell us about Annie Blum. What's her story? The Secret Buttons has been called a fascinating journey through the hardships of life during World War II and through the eyes of two talented, courageous young girls. How might young people of today's America be inspired? Tell us about Annie Blum and the inspiration she still offers.
Okay, Annie Blum is my fictional character.
Uh-huh.
Who's more than 10 years younger than my mother was at the time. For one reason is that today, heroines or main characters in children's books have to be children, or teen books need to be teens, not adults. And so also making her into a child made it more dramatic, more exciting, and more accessible to children than to say a 23-year-old woman
right.
who had to interrupt her medical school education because of the Anschluss went on a train from Vienna to Hoek van Holland to take a boat to England where she was going to live with relatives as a domestic servant, but to make her a 12-year-old. Taking care of her little sister, Rosie, who's 7 years old, and a very obstreperous little girl who stamps her feet, who has tantrums, who's got to hold on to her dolly, all kinds of stuff. So all of a sudden, Annie Blum is put in the position of being a caretaker to her young sister, of keeping her quiet on the train, of remembering everything Mutti, her mother, Mutti is how you say mommy in German. That's about one of the only German words I know, because my mother and aunts called their mother Mutti. She's got big responsibilities, but it's a very scary time. Will they get discovered with their visas, their forged visas? Will they get discovered? Are their noses too big? Is their hair too dark and curly?
Right.
Will they get noticed as Jews on this train where no Jews are, all the Jews are supposed to be thrown off, taken away? Their papa was already taken away. But this is their one and only opportunity to survive. And their mother doesn't want to say goodbye to them, and they don't want to say goodbye, but they have to all face reality.
And
this is their way to be safer during the war. Little did they know what they were getting into.
Yeah.
That England was deep into wartime preparations when they arrived.
So how might young people of today's America be inspired? How does this relate to them?
It could relate to them, first of all, to see how these characters used their talents and intelligence to make a difference.
That's what young people need.
To make a difference, to help others to learn and to grow. And if they're immigrants themselves from another country, and coming to America
right.
means learning a new language, adjusting to a new culture, getting teased, just like the characters in this book are, they can learn from them. It wasn't easy for my characters to learn English.
Yeah.
You know, it's a pretty funny chapter where they're pronouncing all the English words as if they were in German and getting laughed at, where they're being teased. Well, they speak German. They must be Nazi spies. What are they doing here? Say the neighborhood lads. So to learn from them how little by little they overcame these challenges and began to be full and respected members of their new community.
That is an important thing to teach to young people. Ellen, you've taught middle graders in religious schools, and you found that young people, they want to learn about the Holocaust. Why do they need to hear the whole story of devastation and resilience beyond just reading the Diary of Anne Frank and memoirs by camp survivors? How is that not enough?
First of all, I'm not sure they even read the Diary of Anne Frank.
Right.
They knew about Anne Frank. They knew that she hid with her family in an attic, but that ultimately she was taken away and died in a concentration camp.
Right.
But her literature lives on. Her heritage lives on. But what about characters who survived?
Yes.
What about characters who were not victims? I looked at a number of other so-called Holocaust books, all very good ones for young people. And generally speaking, the main characters are not the Jewish people. The main characters are what we call righteous Gentiles.
Right, right.
The people who hid Jews in barns and in their own homes, who got themselves into a lot of danger by doing that. The people who helped Jews who went, say, from Denmark to Norway.
Yeah.
Who, and so forth. How about a book in which the Jewish characters are the heroes, in which the Jewish characters solve the problems, not other people?
That's a good point.
So my students inspired me because I saw, first of all, that the Holocaust was not part of the curriculum.
Right.
They weren't teaching about Judaism and the kids' experience in religious school, which is usually on Sunday morning and one evening during the week, to be a joyous and positive one, with singing, you know, with learning about positive contributions of Jews around the world and learning about Jewish holidays and preparing for their bar and bat mitzvahs and so forth. And let's not go into the Holocaust. That's just too negative to even mention around here.
Yeah.
But the kids, when I asked them, what do you want to learn about, when they really didn't take a liking to my lesson plans, no matter how interesting and exciting I tried to make them, what do you want to learn about? The Holocaust. Oh, so that memory that was in my mind that had, you know, been bubbling up for so long, I know there's a story here. I know there's a story they will want to read, or I hope they will want to read.
Interesting. Your book reveals the importance of religion in times of turmoil and crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that, please.
Well, let me tell you about it from the point of view of my characters. For me,
sure,
it's very important. For a lot of people that I know, because I'm an active synagogue goer. My husband is a rabbi, not always.
Uh-huh.
He's an attorney and still is, but he's a rabbi for 14 years of a synagogue in Connecticut. But for people like my family, should I call them atheists? Maybe that's not quite right. Cultural Jews who
I understand
Jewish people on TV and pointed them out, but who really thought all that religion stuff was, you know, these books are, you know, what they say in the Bible isn't really true.
Right.
Passover, that story, you know, that's kind of a made-up fairy tale about the Egyptian pharaoh and the Egyptians and the Jews were slaves in Egypt. Come on, we can't believe any of that. And we're going to give a little lip service to maybe lighting a Hanukkah candle. They were like pretty typical post-World War II assimilated Jews in America.
Right.
And there was nothing for me to hold on as the... We were in the only house in Inglewood, California, without a lit Christmas tree in the window,
uh-huh,
without plastic Santa Claus on the roof. Something was missing in my life. And luckily, I was able to find it. And so I had my characters find it in the Passover chapter of the book, in which they're asked to read from the Haggadah around the table. And they start reading it. And God reached out to us with a mighty hand and saved us. Oh, they didn't believe that. They didn't want to read. How come God didn't reach out to Papa with a mighty hand when they took him away to the work camp, to Dachau?
Right.
But then somehow, little by little, through learning about it, through being in a more Jewish home where Shabbat is celebrated, Shabbat dinners and prayers, nothing huge, not Orthodox, not,
right,
you know, super frum, but they began to see there's beauty in this. There's value in this. It gives meaning to our life. And we see little by little our character Ani becoming a bit more spiritual when she thinks about life and she thinks about death and she's taking some pride in her heritage. So I'm hoping that readers will, you know, appreciate that too.
Our guest on today's unique edition of Keeping Democracy Alive is Ellen M. Shapiro, author of the new book, The Secret Buttons. And we're discussing that. It's a book aimed for young adults, and it's a little bit different. It's a novel, but it also has, as many novels do, a lot of truth to it. Today, ICE is too obviously a modern-day Gestapo. What can people of all ages and faiths learn from the years leading up to the Second World War and the Holocaust of how to heed the warning signs of oppression and tyranny?
I learned from one very important book about the beginnings of the Holocaust, how it started little by little.
Right.
It turns out that Vienna, Austria, was the Nazis' testing grounds for their, what can I call them, for their techniques, for their innovations. Uh-huh. First of all, we have a city where people lived in large apartment buildings, and it was a cosmopolitan city of professionals.
Sure.
How do you know who the Jewish people are if they're the ones to be picked out, sent away? Part of our, they didn't even call it a final solution yet.
No.
It takes a few years before they got there, but they went to the, they had the same kind of organizations there that we have here, like JCCs, Jewish community centers, nursery schools, hospitals, regular Jewish schools, daycare centers, retirement homes. And they'd go there and say, give me your membership list.
Oh. And
somehow that sounds very familiar to something that's going on right now. Membership list.
Right.
So that's the kind of thing that's happening little by little. And what about going around and rounding up immigrants is also a bit reminiscent of way in future steps, you know, Nazis found the people to be eliminated. Not only Jews, but what they call gypsies, or we now call Roma people, mm-hmm. homosexuals, people with very dark skin, people who were handicapped or had serious disabilities, both mental and physical, were rounded up to be taken away.
Yes, and the other.
First it was assumed they'd all leave and leave their money and valuables behind, which a lot of people did. But those who couldn't leave or did not want to leave, like my grandparents, ended up in a place that they could have never imagined. So it looks like today some people are ending up in places that they could have never imagined.
Well, yeah, sending the immigrants off to horrible conditions in El Salvador, for example, shipping him off to countries that they had nothing to do with. It's all about the other, blaming the other for whatever is going on now. We've seen it before, people. We have. And that's what your book deals with. Even if young readers are not affected by oppression themselves, what might reading The Secret Button instill in young people?
That's a great question. It might instill in them a number of things. One is taking a look at their own talents and abilities. In the case of my characters, it's knitting and sewing and crocheting,
uh-huh.
But also quick thinking, also a love of animals. You know, there's lots of stuff in there that they're involved in. And seeing how these things can help other people, help themselves, help their communities, not to be afraid of those talents, but to celebrate them. Could it be music? Could it be art? Could it be writing? Could it be math and science?
Interesting. Yeah, that will.
And it could maybe inspire young people to read the newspaper, because they could be thinking about what's going on right now. Join protests, write letters, call their congresspeople, become activists. I hope more and more of them are doing so. Get their parents to vote if they can't yet.
Yeah, there's a lot that young people can do. They can be inspired, use their talents for sure. And they can inspire people now to take action against what ICE is doing, for example. Now, we like to believe that attitudes toward welcoming refugees has improved since the time of your book, the time that it focuses on. Have attitudes changed toward welcoming refugees? I mean, we are a nation of immigrants.
We are a nation of immigrants. You know, I would have to go into schools in neighborhoods like the Bronx, where a lot of immigrants live,
right,
and see, are those kids being teased? You know, maybe I watch too much Law and Order, because they make everything look pretty negative. But I hope, I suspect that today that immigrants are not being teased, that immigrants are being welcomed into classrooms and playgrounds and teams and groups like the Brownies and the Girl Scouts and the Boy Scouts and church groups and sports especially. You know, I think that sports and music may be really big influences on kids, and they see how many immigrants are on the Los Angeles Dodgers, who, you know, that won the World Series, and the New York Yankees and every other team. They may be watching international soccer. They may be listening to music from all around the world. So thinking, hey, those are people that I'd like to be friends with.
They can be heroes. They can be heroes. There are people who play on. This is a time of football. Here in Boston, in the Boston area, we pay attention to football, and there are a lot of people on the Patriots who are immigrants, who have names that are very different from other people, but they can be come across as heroes as well. I got to ask you this question. There's long been an imagined worldwide Jewish conspiracy. What is imagined about immigrants today? And what was imagined about the worldwide Jewish conspiracy back for your grandmother or your mother?
Oh, boy. No, the worldwide Jewish conspiracy was made up by the Nazis, that somehow, because Germany was in an economic depression, I don't know what's worse than a depression, but really, it was the fault of the Jews.
Right.
The Jews have all the money. The Jews run the banks.
It's not true. And the banks are run by WASPy people.
It's not true. The Jews were poor most of the time. You know, it was finally of my grandfather's generation that Jews got to be doctors and lawyers and engineers. Be in professional classes. Before that, I think most Jews were very poor, and they were scholars or they were farmers, and they lived in small towns in Poland and Belarus and Russia and so forth, and not allowed to participate in a lot of community life. So do we still think that there's a worldwide Jewish conspiracy? I don't think so. But when someone calls Mexicans murderers and rapists,
right,
it's just putting a similar label on another group. And this really makes me angry, having grown up in Los Angeles in an area that is heavily Mexican American. We would now, what was called Chicano when I was in college.
Right.
And also living in an area now, Westchester County, New York, where who are the people who take care of our children, who serve us in restaurants, who mow our lawns, who keep our houses clean? They are generally immigrants.
Yes.
From Latin America somewhere or the Caribbean somewhere. If you have, when I had my son and lived in Manhattan, all of the babysitters were immigrants from Jamaica who had children, Jamaica and Haiti, who had children at home, who left their children at home with the rest of their family to live in Brooklyn to take care of white people's children in New York City and send money home to support their own children, their own families. These are the people who took care of us and take care of us. And to put them all into one great big barrel of murderers and rapists, you know, I can't stomach that at all.
No.
That way.
Well, you're a decent person, a patriotic American, obviously, and that kind of thing does bother a lot of people. And, you know, this is not, this crackdown on so-called illegal immigrants, I mean, nobody is illegal, but it's happened before. It happened under Woodrow Wilson during the First World War. They cracked down on anybody with a German last name. And they were highly dubious of any immigrants at all. It comes and goes, and it's important for young people especially to be aware that this is not, that, you know, Germany was not the only place where this happened, and Austria is not the only place where this happened. It's happening here now. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. Our guest on today's edition of Keeping Democracy Alive is Ellen Shapiro, who's got a new book out, The Secret Buttons. And you say one of the most significant projects I edited and designed was a newsletter series called Dialogue. Tell us about that, please.
Dialogue was published by the Institute of Mental Health Initiatives, a group of psychologists and psychiatrists in Washington, D.C., who felt strongly that too much violence on television was negatively impacting the mental health of children, especially, but of our whole society. And they raised money to kick off a campaign called Channeling Children's Anger. They kicked off, to say this, at the Kennedy Center. Now some people call it the Trump, the Trump Kennedy Center. Inviting screenwriters, television writers, producers, and directors to learn about how to model healthier depictions of anger and of other emotions in primarily in television shows, but also in music videos. And so I was the designer and editor of a series of newsletters that went out to this, what they call the creative community of media people. And they felt it really made a difference in how the writers would come to them and say, we're working on a screenplay about such and such. You know, what is the best way to show this? So that was important work for me.
Uh-huh. And especially among we Jews, you say, quote, we've seen how in times of turmoil, Jews and others stick together to pray, write editorials and letters to the editor, join protests, post their feelings on social media, etc. In your mind, are such efforts actually working? And how does that relate to this book, The Secret Buttons?
I'm going to answer that question backwards.
Okay.
And say that I'm working on a second website in addition to my website, visuallanguage.net, which introduces the book and my design work and so forth, a website for readers called secretbuttons.com that will have a place for readers, especially people from immigrant families or people who have kids who have newly arrived in America to post their own writing, to post their drawings, to post their memories of what it was like for them to come here, what it was like to be a stranger in a strange land, and what they did about it. So I'm working on that right now, doing, first of all, a teacher's guide for the book to be on there, and questions and answers, role-playing scenarios. So the kids in school today could say, could act out a scene from the book. The teacher could say, let's see, you are newly arrived, and the neighbor kids tease you for having a foreign language. Or in the case in the book, they're, Annie and Rosie are teased, are called, they're spies, they're Nazi spies by the neighborhood boys in the English village where they're living, because they speak German. Well, Germany was already the enemy. They're digging Anderson shelters in their backyards to be safe when the Germans fly bomber planes on their way to bomb targets in London. So what are these Germans doing in our village? Okay, here's a scenario. You are being teased for speaking this foreign language. Right. What do you do? How do you think, feel, what do you say, what do you do? So there'll be five scenarios in here. So I'm working backwards to answer your question, going backwards from what kids can do to relate what's happening in the book to what's happening in the world in our country today, what might be happening in their school and in their own lives.
Right. And how is this book being received? It's targeted at what age group? And how is it being received?
It's written in, I say, fifth grade and up, age 10 and up.
Uh-huh.
That depending on the child's maturity, some parents of 10-year-olds really, like my own son, doesn't think that his son, age 9, is really needs to know at this point in time that Jews had been picked out and sent away to concentration camps, even though it was his own great-great-grandfather, I think so. Anyway, some parents of 10-year-olds who live in New York City, it's something they live with every day because their grandparents live nearby and might be survivors or might be children of survivors. So it depends on the age of the child and the family circumstances. But yes, it's written with middle grade language that we think that the good fifth grade reader should be able to easily read. There is a glossary in the back for foreign words that you might not, they might not know, not just English words, but German words and, British expressions that pop up in the book. But adults who read it and older teens who read it like it too. Nobody has said to me, oh, this book is too juvenile for me. It's just a children's book. That's one thing that I found really interesting about it, that it's getting incredible response. This is just a brand new thing that's happening for me, doing radio interviews, some speaking engagements, and finding out how people are responding to it, and it's very, very positively for all ages.
Well, and so how is it being received in schools, do you think?
Has not been in schools yet.
Ah.
That is my next outreach program. I am writing letters to education directors at synagogue Sunday schools. And from there, I will work on letters or to school districts, starting with my own school district. I'm going to be starting with my public libraries right here nearby in Westchester County. Three of them, actually. I'll have speaking engagements at. One of them is at knitting groups, the teenage knitting group. Knitting is a kind of a motif that goes through the book, from knitting on a train to knitting at night to fall asleep and kind of calm anxiety, from knitting to make yourself clothing, and finally to knitting sweaters that the diamonds can be hidden in. And it, I shouldn't say finally, because finally is starting a knitting table in multicultural Brooklyn, New York, after the girls have come to America. Uh-oh, I gave away the ending. What do you call it? Spoiler alert.
I won't tell, but knitting is really popular these days. Kids are into knitting. It's like a new thing.
That's great.
It's a new thing.
Knitting is something you can do when you watch TV. It's so relaxing, and kids are into creativity of all kinds. Make yourself a sweater or a garment that you've designed, that you've picked the yarn, you've picked the pattern, and you put it together little by little. It's fun. And now it can be kind of fast and easy with large yarn and large needles.
I have no idea.
Make something in a couple of days, a really cool vest, scarf, hat. I want to see more boys knitting, too.
Yes, it's starting to happen. I've been seeing it here and there. And I feel like, good for them. It shows some chutzpah, shall we say, being able to take on something that's so feminized. But your book deals with assumptions about people and breaking through those assumptions. And that's an important thing for young people, especially, to learn. Your chapter 9 is called Uncle Benjamin's Dilemma. Tell us about that, please.
Yeah. Okay. So Uncle Benjamin is the head of the household where the girls are staying. He is a distant relative of their papa, who is in the camp. He's a diamond and watch merchant. Nobody's wearing diamonds, you know, during pre-war England. And his wife, Aunt Vivian, while they're sitting around, she remarks about, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be back in the days when I wore my blue satin gown and my diamond solitaires to go to a receptions in honor of the Duchess of Kent. And so Annie is sitting there knitting, crocheting around button molds, wooden button molds. And she thinks about Uncle Benjamin's dilemma, which is all these people who had sent him money for safekeeping before the war started. These were professional people in what were now Nazi-occupied countries who had savings, and they knew that the Nazis were starting to take it away.
Right.
You got to leave, and you're leaving all your money and your valuables with us. So up to a certain point, people could send money to, if they were lucky enough to have relatives in the United Kingdom, for safekeeping in the Bank of England. But there is this problem that during wartime, no money or valuables could leave the country. It was all needed for the war effort. And in Annie's mind, and that's the big painting that opens that chapter, there's a whole lineup of people in Uncle Benjamin's study, which has books from floor to ceiling, a telephone on the table, and the lineup of people are asking for his help. There's her grandparents, there's her parents, there's Orthodox Jews in black hats with payas with a yellow star. There is a gypsy woman, a Roma person, and a little gypsy violinist. There's a very dark-skinned woman. And there are a couple of people who we would consider to be disabled. A boy with club feet and a man in a wheelchair that I actually had my illustrator copy Franklin Roosevelt's wheelchair. And they all need help. And Uncle Benjamin's dilemma is, how can I help them? So here's where what makes this book or story different is Ani, instead of being a victim in that line, is the one who solves the problem. Ah, she figures. Aunt Vivian, may I see those earrings? Oh, why, dear? Oh, I'd just like to see them. Brings them down, and Ani picks up her crochet hook, and instead of crocheting around a wooden button mold, crochets around the diamond and turns it into a button. And this could happen, because I have right on my shelf here two of my mother's old knitting and sewing books from the 1940s, and they show the wooden button molds and give instructions how to crochet around them. So she crochets around this diamond solitaire earring. And people, you know, everybody says, ha ha, it's going to fall. It's going to fall out. And Annie goes, not if I crochet around it. She learned how to stand up for herself. And so, and then they say, oh, it's going to fall off. Buttons always fall off sweaters. Not if I sew them on. And so she sews it onto the sweater she's working on, and she has everybody pull and tug, and it won't come off. And that's when Uncle Benjamin says, I've got a job for you. 12 people are leaving on a boat to America from Liverpool in a fortnight. In 2 weeks.
Right.
Can you make 12 sweaters with diamonds crocheted? And there you have the spoiler alert in detail.
Well, that's okay. There's a lot of illustrations in the book. I mean, this is a book for young adults, and so it can't just be words. I mean, it could be, but tell us, there's some really interesting and very creative illustrations just throughout the book. Tell us about your illustrator, Katrina Baldi.
Katrina Baldi.
Katrina.
Lives on the eastern Adriatic coast of Italy.
Oh, wow.
I have never met her, but we have had a long and fruitful working relationship. I met her through a website called Reedsy, Reedsy.com, that connects authors with editors and illustrators. And some of the best people in the world are on that website looking for jobs. And I had already tried out a couple of illustrators who just didn't get it. You know, I had a little, like, test. I want you to draw these two little girls who have dark curly hair.
Right.
Disguised as Aryans, A-R-Y-A-N-S. So one illustrator puts them in Arab burqas. I said, no, that's not going to work.
No.
And I tried myself using newspaper clippings and photographs of the time as backgrounds. And I said, no, we really need to have the illustrator be able to draw the whole scene. Don't make it so layered and sophisticated. Let's draw the whole scene. And when I saw Katerina's work, how beautifully she does landscapes and cityscapes and architecture and nature, trees, flowers, people, and turns out she's one of the leading children's book illustrators in Europe, has won many awards for the beautiful books she's done in Italian and French and now English for European publishers. And so I would send her like a description. This is the scene, you know, I described just Michael Benjamin's study, just the way I described it to you. And then I'd send her some what we call scrap pictures. Here's what the telephone exactly looked like. Here's what I think I would like to see these characters wearing. Here's the wheelchair that I'd like to put in there. And then they were all done that way. And she did the compositions. She'd send me a couple of sketches. And we talk about it, and I might send her some more details of how about including this, or how about having Cousin Ronald's arm not over Rosie's shoulder. I don't want people to think that they're boyfriend and girlfriend, you know, things like that. Or these are the flowers that should be in bloom at the time in England. And she did 16 magnificent paintings that open each chapter, and then about 50 spot illustrations for small things like the wooden button molds, like posters, like chamber pots.
These are things that can keep the kids involved, I imagine. I mean, it's not just...
I hope so.
You want the kids to turn the pages and be excited about what comes next. If you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. The show is Keeping Democracy Alive. We're talking about a new book called The Secret Buttons with its author, Ellen Shapiro. It's a kid's book, but it's important, especially in this age where the Trump regime is targeting the others, be it immigrants. Back then it was against Jews. And they're still keeping lists of who's working in universities, which Jews are working in universities. It's coming down, folks. So this book is important for young people to get a hold of. It's called The Secret Buttons. Again, jumping ahead a little bit, at the conclusion of the book, the girls arrive in America and are surrounded by people speaking different languages, of different races and cultures. Do you believe that America's strength is its diversity, and are we at risk of losing sight of that in this day and age?
Is that a question for me?
Yeah, it is. Are we at risk of losing that?
Okay, well, it depends who you listen to and what you read. I read the New York Times.
Right, so
and Atlantic Magazine. And the New Yorker. So it seems to me that more and more and more people are not losing sight of that. And that they are fed up. They are fed up and, you know, don't want to see anything like this happen anymore, ever.
Yeah.
And some people are thinking, well, we've got 3 more years to go. And it looks like other people are thinking, let's put an end to this as soon as we can.
Yes.
But you can talk to people who are experts at politics.
I have been known to do that, yes. But
you have been known to do that. Going back to the illustrations for
yes,
1 second, if
sure.
I may.
Yes,
if
please.
People are really interested, on my website, visuallanguage.net, visuallanguage.net, there are videos of Caterina Baldi making these illustrations. So you can see the steps that I just described about starting with a sketch and adding more and more details and color and so forth. So it's fascinating to see because she did it all on her iPad in a painting
amazing.
Program.
Amazing. And I will put the cover of the book on the webpage when this is published soon. America's strength has always been our diversity. Are we at risk, do you think, of losing that? Part of the Nazi strategy was to dehumanize Jews and to force their neighbors to view them as the other, as we surely know. One way in which that was accomplished was to force Jewish men to adopt the additional compulsory name Israel, while Jewish women had to add the name Sarah to their given names. Why was this act of renaming so hurtful and effective in marginalizing Jewish people?
You know, Bert, I didn't even know about that until I started doing research for the book. It wasn't something that is common knowledge that was ever dramatized before, as far as I know. But it's true that at least in Austria and Germany, once they knew where all the Jewish people lived, they could round them up, have them come to a place like a large meeting hall, give up their passports, get an identity card with a big J stamped on the cover, and then have their name changed. So, yes, all the men were Israel.
Jeez.
So if my grandfather was Samuel Nussbaum, he would be Israel hyphen Samuel Nussbaum, and my grandmother was Irene Nussbaum, so she would be Sarah hyphen Irene Nussbaum. Everybody got those names. So you're all one of a group, a marginalized group. And yet, this is very interesting, that these are important names to the Jewish people in a positive sense. You know, every year we read the Torah from the beginning to the end.
Right.
And right now, having finished the book of Genesis, the character of Jacob got his name changed from Jacob to Israel as the founder of the Israelite people. And part of the Amidah, the main prayer that Jews say every Shabbat, and if they go to synagogue, and some people say three times a day, that name, Israel, Jacob, Jacob is part of it. And if they are Reformed Jews or liberal Jews, they say the name Sarah. They add the four mothers, F-O-R-E, mothers, who were the wives of the forefathers of our faith. Sarah. So, Yaakov and Sarah. They are positive names. I don't know if the Nazis realized that, or maybe there was someone there who said, who is, I don't know what the right word is, didn't really want to be part of this, and thought, well, these could be names that they at least could be a little bit proud of.
Well,
but still, it was a pretty awful thing to do, to round everybody up and give them the same first names. You're all part of this social class, religious class, that we want to get rid of. So we're going to get rid of all the Israels and all the Sarahs.
And certainly a lot of the people who support ICE, I can't imagine anybody supporting ICE, but there are people who support ICE. They'll just make up names for Mexicans and others, and, you know, something that they think can stereotype them. Well, you say
Girl
you
Jose or something like that, right?
Yeah. You say you wanted to create a book with an optimistic ending, an ending in America that is hopeful and inspirational. Did you succeed?
I sure think so. And I succeeded in a little bit of a roundabout way, because when not only the knitting table that you've already described with a multicultural group of people, of students, now from Annie's High School and Rosie's Middle School around it, enjoying knitting together and enjoying the same treats that they had in back in Vienna, only the Dobosch Torte, instead of being totally made from scratch, it's from a cake mix. And instead of whatever, instead of their hot chocolate, perhaps, they have Coca-Cola on the table. So, and they learn how to speak like Americans, but when they turn in their diamonds to a Mr. Izzy on 47th Street in the then starting up Diamond District of refugees from, you know, from Europe, from Holland, Belgium, and so forth. Mr. Izzy says, so what are you going to do with the money? And Rosie says, I'm going to save it for my college education. I want to be a veterinarian. Oh, veterinary school, that's too hard.
No.
And she says, no, I'm getting all A's in science and math, and I'm going to veterinary school. And Annie says, well, I want to open up knitting shops, needlework shops, right here on Fifth Avenue and all over, so all the immigrants can come to learn to knit and sew and make beautiful things for themselves and their families. Oh, entrepreneur, you can't do that.
No.
You have to stay home and have babies, is basically what he says. And she thinks to herself, Mr. Izzy should be minding his own business. So I hope you think that's an optimistic
thing. That sounds like a very...
I make them into early feminists.
Sounds like a very optimistic ending.
My mother stayed home until my youngest brother graduated from high school.
Well, it sounds like a very optimistic ending. The book is called The Secret Buttons, and who is the publisher?
It's Visual Language Books, my own company.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. It's very different and something inspirational for young people to get into. The book is called Secret Buttons, and our guest has been its author, Ellen M. Shapiro. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This has been delightful speaking with you.
Much success to you. Thank you. She wants a young American. If you enjoyed that discussion, don't miss a single show. Subscribe. It's all free. So subscribe. It's on Apple, Spotify, Substack, Progressive Radio Network, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, and of course, the website, KeepingDemocracyAlive.com. Thanks very much.
You're tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public